From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. The director of CARE International in Iraq, who was kidnapped on Tuesday, has appeared on a videotape pleading with British Prime Minister Tony Blair to withdraw troops from Iraq. NPR's Anne Garrels has this report from Baghdad.
Exhausted and visibly terrified, Margaret Hassan appeared on a videotape aired on the Arabic television station Al Jazeera.
Please help me. Please help me. This might be my last hours. Please help me.
Hassan, who has Irish, British, and Iraqi citizenship, begged Prime Minister Blair to withdraw British troops and not bring them to Baghdad. Britain has announced it will redeploy soldiers to the Baghdad region in order to reinforce American efforts to put down the insurgency. Hassan said, "I don't want to die like Bigley," a reference to British hostage Kenneth Bigley, who was decapitated earlier this month.
Please, please, beg of you, I beg of you.
Hassan, who was married to an Iraqi, has led CARE's humanitarian work in Baghdad for 13 years. Anne Garrels, NPR News, Baghdad.
House and Senate negotiators acknowledged today they have yet to agree on proposed reforms of the U.S. intelligence community. A conference committee will work through the weekend to craft a bill that could be put to a vote before the November 2nd elections. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
Senate and House members all say it's important to write a compromise bill before the momentum for intelligence reform slows. At stake is how to respond to the 9/11 Commission, which recommended the establishment of a national intelligence director. The House and Senate bills differ on how much authority the position should carry. Republican Congressman Peter Hoekstra of Michigan, the conference chairman, says everyone agrees a weak director is worse than none at all.
So it is about constructing a strong national intelligence director to provide the leadership to the intelligence community that we all feel is needed.
Hoekstra's House Republicans have nevertheless favored a somewhat more limited role for the intelligence director than the Senate has proposed. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
President Bush and Senator John Kerry continued their attacks on each other with the election just 11 days away. Mr. Bush unveiled a new stump speech in which he said Kerry doesn't understand the terrorist threat and isn't up to the job of defending America. Kerry's campaign branded the new speech as untruthful as the old one and reiterated the Democratic candidate's commitment to national security. Kerry campaigned in Milwaukee, where he addressed women's issues and labeled Mr. Bush out of touch on jobs, the concerns of women, and the economy. The president told supporters in Ohio that the employment picture is improving and said Kerry had failed to support reform of medical malpractice law. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down 108 points today at 97.57. Trading was active at 1.5 billion shares. The NASDAQ Composite was down 38 points. This is NPR News. A French court has told school authorities to hold a disciplinary hearing to resolve the issue of three Sikh youths suspended from school for wearing religious headdress. Eleanor Beardsley reports from Paris.
The three teenagers had been wearing what is known as a keski, or underturban, since a law banning ostentatious religious symbols in schools went into force in France in September. The boys' lawyers argued that the hairnet-like underturban does not violate the new French law. In the Sikh religion, males are required to let their hair grow uncut and wear a turban. The court said the school's failure to give the boys the chance to argue their case before a disciplinary hearing was a serious breach of their right to a defense. The ruling means there was no clear decision yet on the legality of the keski, which members of France's 7,000-strong Sikh community have been waiting for. About 300 Sikh boys attend French state schools, and in other cases, school authorities have accepted the wearing of a keski. Earlier this week, five Muslim girls were expelled for refusing to remove their headscarves. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Paris.
The Transportation Security Administration said today that the government has begun conducting background checks on all foreigners seeking to attend flight schools in the U.S. The security measures are partly aimed at stopping potential terrorists from taking flying lessons, as some of the September 11th hijackers did. Background checks now apply to any foreigner seeking flight training in the U.S. and not just to people learning to fly large aircraft. The TSA also says those who want to attend flight school a second time will need a second background check. And a new Federal Trade Commission report says tobacco companies are spending record amounts to market cigarettes, but their sales are still falling. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Weird U.S., your travel guide to America's local legends and best-kept secrets, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com, and from Nonesuch Records, featuring A Ghost Is Born, the new album by Chicago band Wilco, on tour across the U.S., available at all Barnes & Noble music locations.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many of the greatest cartoonists of the 20th century were published in the New Yorker magazine, which is one reason why many New Yorker readers over the decades have turned first to the cartoons. Every cartoon ever published in the magazine since its 1925 debut, that's a total of 68,647 cartoons, are collected in the Complete Cartoons of the New Yorker. It's a book and double CD collection. Today we'll be hearing from several cartoonists featured in the collection, Bruce Eric Kaplan, Gayon Wilson, Roz Chast, and my first guest, Robert Mankoff, who also edited the collection. He's been the magazine's cartoon editor since 1997. He got the job 20 years after he sold his first cartoon to The New Yorker. Mankoff edited several earlier collections of the magazine's cartoons, including its 75th anniversary collection. He's also the founder and editor of the internet cartoon database, The Cartoon Bank. I spoke with him in 2002 after the publication of his book, The Naked Cartoonist, about the art and craft of cartooning. Robert Mankoff, welcome to Fresh Air. I'm going to ask you to describe your most famous cartoon.
All right, well, here is my most famous cartoon. It's quite simple, and maybe that accounts for its fame. There's a guy on the phone. He's an executive, clearly a busy executive. He's pointing to his Rolodex, and he's got his phone to his ear, and he's saying, "No, Thursday's out. How about never? Is never good for you?" I know from statistics assiduously compiled that's my favorite cartoon, because that's the one people license the most, that's the one they buy prints of, and that's the one when I'm at a party and they say, "You know what cartoon of yours I like best?" And I say, I do know what it is, and I tell them that, and I'm right.
Why do you think it struck a chord?
I think it was in 1993, and it seemed to sort of symbolize just that the hectic, harried nature of our lives, where we're constantly meeting and associating with people which we often don't want to associate with, and we're trying to obfuscate and say the polite thing, and this somehow was really saying what people were really thinking on some of these phone calls.
You became the cartoon editor of The New Yorker in 1997. Why don't you just describe what the job is?
It's an interesting job. It's not, I guess, what people think. Often when I go around and I give talks or people find out I'm a cartoon editor, they said, "Well, that's the greatest job in the world." Imagine it, that it's something like, I don't know, being a candy taster, you know, or eating all the best food, you know, the food you really love. And it's a great job because I love cartoons, but the process by which, well, I'll give you for an example, like on a normal week, I will see 34 or 40 contributors to the magazine who do cartoons, and I'll see cartoons that unsolicited and solicited cartoons, you know, by mail. I might look at 1,000 cartoons in 2 days. So when I'm looking at the cartoons, it's probably taking me about 10 seconds or less to look at each cartoon, and at that point, just in a preliminary way, decide, do we want to use it? Do I like it? Is there something there? And then I'm going to go back and look at them again. But I'm not laughing, or almost rarely. I'm sort of just processing. There's so much to look at. And if I went on sort of some sort of, you know, gut instinct, like, am I laughing at the cartoon? Well, it would be sort of like if you were tasting bonbons and you were trying to judge them and you were saying, gee, this 1,000th bonbon, why doesn't it taste as good as the 5th? It wouldn't make any sense. So I try to bring some sort of principles to just the initial selection of the cartoons. Then after I make a selection out of about 1,000 of maybe 50 cartoons that I then take in an art meeting and I show to David Remnick, and we have baskets, yes, no, and maybe. And then David and I, and sometimes
he's the editor of The New Yorker.
The editor of The New Yorker basically choose the cartoons. And in the end, David chooses them. He's got to pick out of these bunch which ones he thinks makes overall sense for the magazine. And we have differences of opinion, and, you know, sometimes he gives in to me, but he's usually the editor, so he usually gets his way.
So you have to have criteria, because as you said, the thousandth bonbon isn't as tasty
right.
as the first. So what are your criteria? Could you put it into words?
Sure. Well, the first criteria I have for the cartoon is it communicating some idea through the medium of humor? Is it demonstrating, you know, not just funniness, but thinking? Is it making some point? And, of course, we do cartoons that are just silly and just funny. But overall, I think the enduring nature of the New Yorker cartoons is that they strike a chord in someone. People remember them because they make some sort of point. So I'm looking for that, the communication of an idea. Secondly, if it's someone who's new, I'm looking, do they have a distinctive voice? You know, are they doing their own cartoons, or are they, you know, did they basically see a Roz Chask cartoon and think, oh, I can do Roz Chask cartoons? And then thirdly, whether or not how funny the cartoon is not, to me, always the ultimate criteria. Is, for example, if a cartoon is on a topic that's been beaten to death, then it's got to be very funny. While if it's on some topic that's never been discussed before for the first time, then as far as I'm concerned, I'll say, well, yeah, let's use this cartoon. No one has ever done a cartoon about the fact that men don't like hair on their back or whatever it is.
What's the editing process like? Do you work with cartoonists on improving the work or, you know, making it funnier, changing the drawing?
Well, very little, because one of the things is that the cartoonists submit 10 or 15 ideas every week. And it's a little bit like a type of haiku, you know what I mean? You can fiddle with it a little bit, but one of the things especially that's evolved in the New Yorker cartoon is this idea of authenticity. The cartoons, I would say, I mean, everything else in the magazine goes through a very, very elaborate editing process where things get written and rewritten, and of course it's still the person's work, but there's often a lot of hands in it. Here, you know, when you're looking at Roz Chast's cartoon, it's Roz Chast. Nobody else wrote the line for her. Every once in a while, I'll make a suggestion, like with someone like Roz, if there's many panels, I'll say something like, you know, I think panel 4 is weak. You know, I think you could do a little bit more. It's more of encouragement. The people are very talented, and they want to come up with their ideas. See, in a caption, let's say, 10 or 15 words, yeah, we'll change a word, but I don't want to really start rewriting it because then it becomes my work. And one of the things about the New Yorker cartoon, and when you're looking at it, it says, is it really the work of the person who does it. The editing, I think, primarily is in the selection and really in the criteria. It was very different at one time. When the magazine started out in the 30s and 40s, there was a lot more, not so much editing, but as straight-out gag writing. People like Peter Arno, for the most part, didn't write any of their captions, or Helen Hokanson, very, very few. So it might be one writer, it might be more like sort of a Broadway show model where someone does the music and someone, you know, does the lyrics.
So someone would come up with the gag and then the cartoonist would be brought in to come up with the image?
Yeah, but more collaborative than that. But,
they worked as teams.
But the roles were clearly assigned. Helen Hokanson might draw pictures and talk with her collaborator, and he might come up with lines, and they might go back and forth. But it was different than it is now.
Who were some of your heroes when you were reading The New Yorker before you started working there?
Well, I, like everybody else, Charles Adams and George Price. But I would say my main influence, although my cartoon certainly veered very, very far away from it, was Saul Steinberg. There was something so, and it was hardly to say even that they were cartoons, but there was something sort of so deeply intellectual about those cartoons, and I had quit graduate school to become a cartoonist, so Saul Steinberg was sort of my way station.
Can you give an example of one of his cartoons that influenced you?
Well, I think I'm trying to remember it. He engaged in this wonderful sort of you know, almost fake writing, very elaborate writing. And there's a guy at quite simple cartoon. It's a loan office, and there's this guy asking for the loan. And in the speech balloon that's coming out is all this elaborate writing, but it's all just shaped like a no. Almost like the Constitution, you know.
Right.
But in this wonderful and also you know and also very very artistic as well. And the elaborate pictures that really can't be summarized on the radio would just sort of spark my imagination and think. I guess what it made me think is that this was something you could aspire to. That something wonderful could be done in this field. That it could be more than just. A joke, or more than I had grown up drawing Donald Duck and Bugs Bunny in school, and it could sort of be. I quit graduate school and I said, well, gee, the New Yorker could sort of be the Harvard of cartooning.
No, you sold your first cartoon to the New Yorker in 1977. What were some of the things that you drew before that didn't get in, that got your rejection notices?
Yeah, I did hundreds of cartoons, and I actually got a number of them published. I'm thinking of some of them now. One of them is it's in the book. It shows a jester, and he's in a very gloomy cell. He's hanging by his hands, and he's peering out the window to the guard, and it's a court jester, and he's saying, "Please tell the king I've remembered the punchline."
Yeah, I like that one.
A couple, a middle-aged couple, they're just reading the paper in the living room, and you see in the picture says it's not someone's knocking at the door, and the woman is saying to the man, "Quick, hide! That may be my husband."
That's a kind of variation on the no sex theme.
Right, it is. Yeah, yeah, it is. And when I look back on this, I mean, sometimes I flip that. You know, around where you take a situation that is a very, very common situation, and then by somehow looking at it in a different way, like I might have a couple just at breakfast reading the paper, drinking coffee, and the woman might be saying, "You know, Dave, I think the divorce has just been a little bit too amiable."
Now, in talking about rejection notices, in your new book, The Naked Cartoonist, you reprint a letter you got from David Mamet shortly after you became cartoon editor, and then you print the note you sent him in return.
Right.
So read us the two.
Well, David Mamet, I'll do this from memory. I think it's pretty
close. This is David Mamet, the screenwriter and playwright
director. Right, the screenwriter. Well, and cartoonist, I guess, because he did cartoons, and I think he has published some cartoons. He sent me, he said, when I became cartoon editor, Dear Mr. Mankoff, congratulations on becoming cartoon editor. I've taken the liberty of sending you a bunch of cartoons. And I looked at them, and I wrote him back this note saying, thanks very much. I've taken the liberty of sending you a play.
Why did you do that?
Just snottiness. But partly.
Because it's really a way of saying to him, you may be a great writer, but your cartoons aren't very good. I mean,
let's put it more gently, not right for us. That's what I learned basically in being an editor. You don't say things are not good. You say they're not right for us.
Right.
There is a certain arrogance that writers have, often captured when they say this to you. I can't draw at all, but their assumption is somehow that they could easily, you know, create great cartoons because they're smart, they're writers, they're funny, and whatnot. And I haven't found it to be the case. Now, last week, Norman Mailer was in my office showing me his cartoons. And I must say, I was a lot nicer to Mr. Mailer than I was in this note to David Mamet. But they weren't actually cartoons, so I don't know if they didn't really fit the criteria so much, whereas actually David Mamet's cartoons were basically attempts to do gag cartoons. And, I mean, I judge them as unsuccessful. Others might think otherwise. I think the problem writers have, and even, you know, great writers, is that they bring all... It's almost like a tremendously muscle-bound person trying to play ping pong. They just bring in too much to it.
Mm-hmm.
They want to show off. They want to show not only are they funny, but they're smart. The other thing that happens, I don't know how to describe this, but even if their cartoons were okay, they it would be hard to use them because the cartoons are become too contaminated by their other persona, so that people couldn't really even see the cartoon. The way I'd explain it is sort of by flipping it and say, let's say you look at Roz Chast cartoons, and you look at them for 20 years, and these wonderful cartoons, and then you meet Roz Chast. Well, it's hard for you just to meet Roz. You're looking at her, but you're not even seeing her, or you are, you're seeing her, but it's somehow contaminated by all your preconceptions about her because of her cartoons.
My guest is Robert Mankoff, The New Yorker's cartoon editor. He also edited The Complete Cartoons of The New Yorker, a book and CD collection featuring every cartoon ever published in the magazine. This is Fresh Air. You can't get a magazine without subscribing or paying for it. You can't get cable TV without paying for it. Public radio is similar and different. It's true that you can listen to us without becoming a member, but that just puts the responsibility on other listeners to call and pledge, because we couldn't function without listener support. Your station is fundraising today, so assuming you can afford it, I hope you will call with a pledge. Thank you. Let's get back to our interview with Robert Mankoff, cartoon editor of The New Yorker magazine. He also edited the collection The Complete Cartoons of The New Yorker.
In a recent edition of The New Yorker, there's a cartoon it's very funny. I thought I'd ask you about it. As our listeners may know, there's a new Museum of Sex in New York, and this cartoon showed exhibits from the Museum of No Sex, and the exhibits included the chastity belt, the headache, the pocket protector, Star Trek memorabilia, and late night television. Talk about deciding to use this particular comic.
Well, I mean, I think, in a way, it's sort of like a common way to flip an idea. And another criteria really that I didn't mention is topicality. A cartoon like this, simply because it talks about this new subject, in a way, doesn't have to be the world's best cartoon. It just sort of interestingly flipped the idea of sex with no sex. I mean, one of the things that changed somewhat in The New Yorker, especially when Tina Brown started being editor, was that sex became a topic. One of the first cartoons I did when Tina became editor for her tenure was, there was a couple, a middle-class couple in bed, and they're reading, and the woman is saying, you're right. Tonight isn't reading night. Tonight is sex night.
Right.
And in a way, both these cartoons have an affinity. One of the things is that, in sort of a subtextual way, this cartoon speaks to the fact that although we have a very sexualized culture, people aren't having much sex.
Well, you have another cartoon about that, and it's there's four middle-aged people in a living room. One's sitting on the couch, one's on an easy chair, another's on another easy chair. One's reading, one's listening to a Walkman, the other's knitting.
Right.
And what's the caption?
I think it's Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, the remake.
Yeah, yeah. And for anyone who doesn't know that movie, that's a movie about like swinging couples having sex with each other in the 60s or 70s, I forget which. So, yeah, I thought that was another funny one on that same theme of people not having sex.
Not having sex. And this is a little bit what I'm talking about as we're discussing these cartoons. You can see what the sort of bedrock criteria for what has become defined as a New Yorker cartoon is. It's topical, but it's not today topical. It's not this week topical. It's contemporary, but it is speaking to the issues of this time.
Can you think of funny ones about having sex?
About having sex. Let me say, I think I did a cartoon where there's a few cartoons. One I did where there's a woman and a man in bed, and they're actually having sex, New Yorker type sex. and sometimes I ask my wife, "You want to have New Yorker type sex or regular sex?" But the woman is saying to the man, "Wow, our first date, and already I feel like it's our second.
Right. After September 11th, how long did it take the New Yorker to feel like it was comfortable or that it was appropriate to publish cartoons that had to do with terrorism?
I think we took a week where we just stepped back. We had one George Booth drawing, which wasn't a cartoon, sort of an anti-cartoon. It just showed one of his usually gay, happy figures depressed. Miss Ritterhouse, she had her violin, but she wasn't playing any music, and the cat just had the head between his hands. But the week after, we sort of edged back into it. The first cartoon we ran after September 11th was a woman saying to a guy at a bar, saying, "Yeah, I never thought I'd laugh again until I saw that jacket." You know, it's got and it showed wonderfully. It showed wonderfully really well. We were going to laugh. People were going to be silly and stupid. And then there was a great cartoon, which is still applicable, is that woman getting on a plane with a cat and a little cat carrier, and a security guy saying, "Ma'am, we're going to have to declaw the cat."
That's good.
So I think we did a pretty good job. Of course, it wasn't about, we didn't do cartoons about the tragic part of it. We did cartoons about the human part and what we were after September 11th, which were still people.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. Whenever you get to New York, come and visit me at the New Yorker. I'd love to show you the place.
I'm glad you said that because I have a few cartoons I wanted to show you. I'm kidding. Don't worry.
And I have a few interviews, of course, I'd like to do.
Robert Mankoff is the cartoon editor of The New Yorker. He also edited the new collection, The Complete Cartoons of The New Yorker. We spoke in 2002. We'll hear from more New Yorker cartoonists in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, cartoons about the perfect family, phobias, and boredom. We hear from New Yorker cartoonists Ross Chast, Gayon Wilson, and Bruce Eric Kaplan.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of A Wizard of Earthsea by Ursula K. Le Guin, the basis for this December's Sci-Fi Channel miniseries, and from BBC America, the innovative British comedy The Office returns with an all-new two-hour special, Saturday and Sunday at 9 p.m. on BBC America.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Every cartoon published in The New Yorker in its nearly 80-year history, that's 68,647 cartoons, is included in the new collection, The Complete Cartoons of The New Yorker. It's a book and two CDs. On today's edition, we're listening back to interviews with New Yorker cartoonists. Ross Chast has published in the magazine since 1978. In the current edition of The New Yorker, her cartoon features a young man in a sweater sitting on the sidewalk behind a table with pamphlets and a donation box. The sign on the table reads, "Jews for Jesus," and also for pissing off one's parents, even if they weren't religious, in a way that the Hare Krishnas can't even begin to imagine. I spoke with Ross Chast in 1987 after the publication of her cartoon collection Mondo Boxo. It included her cartoons Camp Mandatory, where you'll have lots of fun or else. And she described the perfect family. They don't use very much salt, but when they do, they use sea salt. Please take a good look at the label or else you'll probably get the wrong brand.
I guess they're just sort of this sort of perfect, obnoxious little family that you read about a lot in magazines and newspapers, and they're always doing everything sort of right, and they eat right, and they keep fit, and they like themselves a whole lot. And they're very clever, and I'm very happy for them, really.
Are you really? You resent them?
I don't know if I really resent them. I think they're kind of funny.
Did you ever want to be perfect yourself like that?
Oh, of course. I mean, you know, especially when you read about these, oh, I don't know, I can't remember her name. She's some hostess and she has some book out, and I saw her on TV and she was so funny. She was just talking about setting a table for a company, and she just went on and on and on about the placemats and the napkins and the fork and the knife and the spoon and this glass and that glass, and everything was very clever, and, you know, it was like cauliflower centerpieces, and it just was sort of funny.
You have one cartoon called Poets on Strike, about the great poetry strike of 1989, in which they brought in scabs, but the scabs only wrote things like roses are red, violets are blue, sugar is white. And after 6.5 months, an agreement was reached, and even the most depressed poet was happy, sort of. That cartoon made me think of what an unusual job you have. Kind of like the poets going on strike. Poets don't go on strike. Nobody notices poets. And cartoonists, I mean, you're at home all day, most likely, trying to come up with ideas. Is that a difficult and lonely life?
There are times when it's harder than others. When it's going well, it seems like the easiest job in the world. And when it's not, then it's, I wouldn't say, you know, necessarily the hardest job in the world, but then it's just harder.
Are there things that come your way that you save because you know that there will eventually be a good idea for a cartoon?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I don't even know if I think that directly. I do save things here and there that may never find their way into a cartoon, but that I kind of like.
Such as?
Recently I got something. I guess it's a company called the Wisconsin Cheese Man, and it's these huge, well, I guess since it's the Christmas season and all that, it's these huge crates of arrangements of cheeses and summer sausages and petits fours and weird sauces, and it's all arranged so there's like a big cheese in the center, and then it's like a mandala. But
I know exactly what you mean. And is there a little like green, the equivalent of confetti, you know, around it to make it look
like
festive,
like a lawn kind of,
yeah, exactly.
Or something.
So this is going to be used as a cartoon, do you think?
Oh, I doubt it. Maybe in a cartoon about something else completely, that might have a little tiny, you know, cameo role or something.
But that's one of the things I really love about your cartoons. Everything really rings true. There's all these little details about life. Like when you draw that cartoon and there's a little image in passing with this cheese box, I'm going to recognize it because I've seen these cheese boxes. It's those details, I think, that, among other things, that really make your cartoons so special.
Oh, well, thank you.
What else are you saving now?
Oh, let me see. I have all kinds of ridiculous things. How to keep hamster manuals, and what do I have? I have a book called Chickens in Your Backyard. I don't know whether these will ever show up in cartoons. They're just things that I collect that I think are funny, and, you know, they might not. I don't know.
You know, when I first started seeing your cartoons, and I saw that they were by R. Chast, I said to myself, is it a man or a woman? Did people ever think you were a man before you became known as Ross Chast?
Yes, I still occasionally get letters, believe it or not, to Mr. Ross Chast, which is, you know, really insisting on, you know, something, but I just sort of stuck with it. Well, I did go through a tiny phase for a few weeks, I think it lasted, of signing my name Roz Chast, because an editor, a woman editor, had said to me, well, you're a woman cartoonist, and you should let people know you're a woman. And, you know, I mean, that it may be right, but I felt funny. I felt every time I signed it, it's like, oh, well, now she likes me more because I'm signing my name like this. I guess now I'm better in her book. And I felt stupid doing it. I just, you know, said, well, this is not how I really sign my name. This is, I sign it R. Chast. That's how I sign it.
But that's interesting. So you never decided to sign it R. Chast to keep your sexual...
No, that's...
Your gender unknown.
No, not at all. I mean, obviously, if I wanted to do that, you know, in the contents in The New Yorker, when they list the cartoons, I would have had them print R. Chast there, but, you know.
Let me just ask you one last question. Did you, when you started cartooning, did you approach it with the idea of wanting to do it differently than it had been done before?
No, this is not really. This is just really the way I draw. And when I tried to do it the same as other people, I knew that that didn't work at all. That was a disaster. I guess some people, when they get out of college, they really are very much in a lather about what they're going to do next. But, I mean, at the time that I started, I just knew that this is really what I like to do.
Roz Chast recorded in 1987. In 1986, I spoke with Gayon Wilson, whose work is also included in the new collection, The Complete Cartoons of The New Yorker. Many of his cartoons have a macabre and ghoulish sensibility, inspired by horror movies and science fiction. He was also influenced by the late New Yorker cartoonist Charles Adams. I asked Wilson to describe some of his early cartoons.
There's this fellow, and he's in a cannibal pot. He's being cooked. And he has a evil look on his face, and he has a bottle of poison, and he's pouring the poison in the water he's being cooked in, and that was one. And then, let me see, there was one where there's this little kid, and he's with his father, and they're in a snowstorm, and there's this dead bird on the snowbank with his feet in the air, and the little kid's pointing at it, and he says, look, Daddy, the first robin, that kind of stuff. It was very much in keeping with what I do today.
Another theme that recurs in your work, and there's a wonderful chapter on it in your new book, is childhood fears, and especially some of the really irrational ones that we all have. I'd like to go over some of those with you and see if you had them and where you think they came from. The toilet monster is really one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Could you explain the toilet monster?
The toilet monster is... If in the middle of the night you have to go to the bathroom, you have to be very careful because there is this thing who lives down in the works underneath there. All plumbing is a source of great peril and danger because it goes from the known world into the unknown depths there, and that's why we have all these things about. Snakes coming into the bathtub via the drain, and we know, of course, about the crocodiles and the sewers and all that sort of stuff. But there's also this thing which is somehow associated with the toilet. It's down there. And at night, if you flush the toilet, you're liable to waken it, and it may come up and get you. So you have to flush it and get the hell out very quickly.
Were you really worried about that?
Well, thank God I wasn't. This was something that I heard from somebody else. But a lot of the other ones.
Making a face. What's going to happen if you make a
making
face?
Making a face. If you make a face and somebody startles you, like you get slapped in the back, or there's an explosion or backfire, something like that. You've got to watch out because it might freeze on your face forever. So you'll have for the rest of your life. And then a lot of stuff happens is because parents don't understand and make you do things that are obvious, they're fatal. I mean, like eating cherries with milk. Every kid knows eating cherries with milk or something else. It depends on the region and so on. There are various combinations of food which are fatal. And parents don't understand that. And they make the kid do it anyhow. And the kid does it because he's a good kid. And it kills them. And the parents feel very bad because they've done it. But that's life. That's the way it goes. That's part of growing up. And there's also stuff like trying to cope with the mysterious areas, like if something falls down into a drain or something, like a ball or a dime rolls down, don't reach into the thing with your bare hands because something may get it, you know, your fingers or the whole hand and pull you in or something like that. There's no safety if you're a kid anywhere at all.
Did you draw little monsters in the margins of your notebook?
I did. Oh, yes, I did indeed. And I had a strange experience in that I went through some stuff that from the family. My parents are dead, and there was a bunch of stuff there. And there was one box which had these drawings I'd done as a little teeny bitsy kid. And they were pre-literate. You know, I was really a little itsy bitsy. And they're monsters, you know. They're all kinds of stuff like that. And there's one, I remember one has in a mother's loving hand. It says, "A strange monster come to kill us all." And so, I was doing that kind of junk way back then.
Cartoonist Gayon Wilson recorded in 1986. His work is represented in the new collection, The Complete Cartoons of the New Yorker. Coming up, New Yorker cartoonist Bruce Eric Kaplan, known to his readers by his initials BEK. This is Fresh Air. Today we're hearing from some of the cartoonists featured in the new collection, The Complete Cartoons of the New Yorker. Bruce Eric Kaplan signs his cartoons with his initials BEK. His work has been featured in the New Yorker for over 10 years. Kaplan has also written for the TV shows Sybil, Seinfeld, and 6 Feet Under, where he's now an executive producer. I spoke with him earlier this year after the publication of his book, This Is a Bad Time. It collects his cartoons from The New Yorker and other publications, including The Boston Globe and LA Weekly. I asked Kaplan to describe one of the cartoons in his book.
This is a chicken talking to a bird in a farm, in a barn-like setting, and the chicken's saying, "Sometimes I get so bored with myself, I can barely make it to doodle-do."
No, where did that? What made you think about that?
Oh, come on, please! Aren't you? Don't you get? You can't make it to doodle do some mornings.
But I wouldn't
you?
Have thought of the chicken. I just would have thought about myself.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, it's like a whole language, the world of cartoons. I mean, that there's images, classic ones like the people crawling in the desert or the people on the deserted island. But you know, there's a whole. Is it lexicon? Is that using the word correctly?
Sure.
Of just images and worlds that you can sort of take your thoughts and plug them into. Like, a farm setting is a wonderful one, I think. I love farms. I love, not that I've ever been to one, but I love drawing them.
Well, you mentioned desert. You have a great one of two people crawling across the desert.
Right.
Can you describe it?
Sure. It's a woman and man crawling in a desert, looking obviously starving and thirsty, and the woman turns to the man and says, "This isn't really about water, it's about what's going on between us," you know, as if they've been arguing.
Yeah. No. Now, how did you start drawing cartoons? What made you think, this is something I can do?
I just always drew little people. Like, you know, when I was talking on the phone or when I was drawing, I mean, when I was watching TV, I would always draw little people, little men and little women, you know, going about their business. I actually think some holding cocktail glasses the way that I still do for New Yorker cartoons. I mean, I always loved The New Yorker. I was very passionate about Charles Adams. I was definitely, like, very Charles Adams focused as a child and would, you know, take his stuff out of the library constantly, you know, all the time. I just said this the other day. So when I was taking out his books, like, all the time from the library, like, you know, every 2 weeks, I don't know why someone just didn't give me one, but they didn't.
What came first, writing for television or cartooning?
They actually came at the same time. What happened was I had been trying to write for television and not succeeding at it, and I thought, like, oh, I don't remember how it came to me, but I thought, like, I could be a New Yorker cartoonist. I mean, one day it was just like, yes, that I could do. You know, I'm not succeeding at this other thing, but this one I can do. So I, like, you know, read in the library, like, I got a book out, How to Be a Cartoonist, and it said there was an art meeting once a week, and I started submitting. You know, I did 10 drawings and sent them off with a self-addressed envelope, like the book in the library told me to do. And I was, you know, of course, like everything I did at the time, I was sure they were going to buy all 10 drawings. And I just sat there in my apartment and I, you know, drew my next group so I wouldn't miss next week's meeting and sent that off. And then my first envelope came back with a rejection letter, and I was so shocked. I couldn't believe it. It was this form rejection letter. I thought, like, you know, I'd sent them these brilliant things, I thought. And so I just, you know, assumed they had made a mistake on some level and that they were going to buy some of the second group. So I started working on my third group. And then, you know, of course, needless to say, I got my envelope back, the second group. And anyhow, it was a compulsion by this time. And I actually spent a few years sending, you know, 10, 15, 20 cartoons every week. I never missed an art meeting for a few years. And so now I was also concurrently trying to be a sitcom writer and failing at both. So then a few years into it, my friend Kenny had hired me for the Emmy Awards, and I came back from work one day, and instead of my self-addressed envelope, there was a FedEx from The New Yorker, and I just cried. I mean, because I knew something was happening, obviously, and I opened it up, and it was an acceptance letter, you know, and it was such a big deal. It was just like, I had never, I would get these little tiny, they're not even 8.5 by 11, they're like note card rejection letters that are no signature. It was like sending these off into a void. So the idea that finally someone, you know, had read them. I mean, I would write cover letters that said, like, cursing at them, saying, here are, you know, 10 bleeping cartoons that any other bleeping magazine would publish except for you. Because I figured it didn't feel like anyone was actually reading these cartoons. It just felt like they would open them up and put them in my self-addressed envelope and send them back to me. When I got the FedEx, the first line was, I know you think we haven't been reading your stuff, but we have, and here are these cartoons, we'd like you to draw, you know, revise them. And then that led to a new world of horror, because revising, I thought I was drawing these perfect things. I had no idea I was supposed to be revising these images.
What kind of revisions did they ask for?
Oh, God, it's embarrassing now, but I mean, he said, you know, I had no idea. I really did, you know, this is how I was in my 20s. I thought, like, oh, these are perfect. So I called him up. It was Lee Lorenz, the art editor at the time. And I said, like, hi, I'm Bruce Kaplan. I'm excited to do these revisions, but what should I change? And he said, like, well, you see the table in that picture? It doesn't look like a table. You know, a table should have four legs. It was like that type of thing. So he would tell me, you know, things in my drawings that just really weren't cutting it.
Here's a cartoon that I figure relates to writing in some way. Someone's driving in a car along a big deserted strip of highway and passes a billboard, and the billboard says, your own tedious thoughts next 200 miles. And I don't know. To me, that's not only about just kind of having to be alone for a long time on a deserted highway or alone any place like that. I just have a feeling, too, that for you as a writer, maybe it feels that way sometimes, that you have a dry spell and, like, you're just stuck alone with these thoughts.
Oh, my God, have a dry spell. It's never not a dry spell for me. I'm one of those writers who, you know, moans in agony, or cartoonist constantly. You know, why is there no good why are there no good ideas? You know, I despise myself. It's always the same thought going on in my head.
So what do you do to kind of break the dry spell when you're feeling that way? Sit there and hope for the best.
Actually, sometimes it helps to go through the negative emotions in terms of, like, to do a drawing about hating oneself or about, you know, not having any ideas. And maybe that drawing will be great or not, but then it'll be exercised a little bit. and then you'll think about something else that's on your mind, and that will, you know, you'll move forward. I mean, gradually, it's always like a trick to just lose yourself in the process, and if you have faith, then you can. That's my opinion.
Bruce Eric Kaplan is a New Yorker cartoonist whose work is in the new book, The Complete Cartoons of the New Yorker. He's also an executive producer of 6 Feet Under. This is Fresh Air. You may be frustrated listening to our fundraising efforts today, and you may be wondering, why do they have to keep asking listeners for support? Well, the point of public media was to have a place where you didn't have to worry about pleasing commercial sponsors who demand to reach the largest audience possible. Sure, we'd like to reach a large audience, but our real goal is to provide the kind of programming that doesn't exist on commercial broadcast radio, like in-depth news and long-form interviews with some of the most important people in the news, as well as in entertainment and the arts. We can afford to do this because we don't have to cater to advertisers. Instead, much of our budget comes from listeners, directly from listeners. So please, call with a pledge. Thank you. The director, Alexander Payne, has set 3 movies, Citizen Ruth, Election, and About Schmidt, in and around his native Omaha, Nebraska. His new film, Sideways, is his first since moving to Los Angeles. A tipsy road movie, it tells the story of 2 unstable men on a Central California wine-tasting expedition. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
As someone who often ponders the pros and cons of alcohol consumption, I've wondered why no one talks about addicted Epicureans, why Alcoholics Anonymous members, at least in my circles, don't tell horror stories of Chateauneuf-du-Pape obsession or rent money blown on a 25-year-old Glenmorangie with an Armagnac wood finish. I admit, that doesn't sound as nightmarish as, say, waking up from a 3-day blackout on a rooftop, naked, covered in vomit, with 2 cops pointing guns. But there's a class of addicts for whom the connoisseur drive is closely allied with the drive to self-medicate. Epicures go sideways, too, big time. Which brings us to Alexander Payne's Sideways, an ingratiating Epicurean road movie with a steady ache, an ache like a red wine hangover. The protagonist, Miles, played by Paul Giamatti, is a recently divorced middle school teacher, unpublished novelist, and Pinot Noir freak. For him, it's not about getting blotto, or I should say, going sideways. It's about sticking his nose in the latest vintage, sipping, chewing, and savoring. One pronouncement goes, citrus, passion fruit, just the faintest soupçon of asparagus, and like a nutty Edam cheese. And it's about working his way down to the bottom of the bottle, phoning his ex-wife, and stumbling home to pass out like any other drunk. Sideways tells the story of a wine-tasting trip that Miles takes with his best friend Jack, played by Thomas Hayden Church, the week before Jack's wedding. Jack is a washed-up TV actor with a big chest, a tan, and a can-do California disposition, quite a contrast to Miles, who's paunchy, morose, and self-hating. But Jack is an addict, too. Despite his impending nuptials, he makes a play for almost every woman he eyeballs, and ends up embarking on a whirligig, vaguely S&M affair with a tasting room employee named Stephanie, played by Sandra Oh. Jack encourages Miles to get cozy with Maya, a divorced waitress and wine lover, played by a radiantly blonde and even-keeled Virginia Madsen. Here, Miles explains, after a lot of wine, his adoration of Pinot Noir.
Why are you so into Pinot? I mean, it's like a thing with you.
I don't know. It's a hard grape to grow, as you know, right? It's thin-skinned, temperamental, ripens early. It's, you know, it's not a survivor like Cabernet, which can just grow anywhere and thrive even when it's neglected. Nah, Pinot needs constant care and attention. You know, and in fact, it can only grow in these really specific little tucked away corners of the world. And only the most patient and nurturing of growers can do it, really. like somebody really takes the time to understand Pino's potential, can then coax it into its fullest expression. And then, I mean, oh, its flavors, they're just the most haunting and brilliant and thrilling and subtle and ancient on the planet.
You don't need a shrink to tell you that Miles has over-identified with that fragile little grape, or that for all his eloquence, he's also drunk on self-pity. In fact, some viewers will find the attraction of Madsen's Maya for Miles a little mysterious. It's not that Giamatti is totally unprepossessing, just that Miles's moroseness, an intense I'm-a-loser vibe, and oh yes, alcoholism, don't exactly add up to the most promising boyfriend material. Sideways is closely based on a very funny novel by L.A. screenwriter Rex Pickett. As adapted by Payne and his partner Jim Taylor, it's like a gonzo teen comedy smacked upside the head by encroaching middle age and its attendant insults, by bodies and minds that don't recover as quickly or at all from relentless self-abuse, and by the unshakable sense that, as Shakespeare's Richard II puts it, I wasted time, and now doth time waste me. And yet, even here, there are patches of blissful connectedness, fleeting ones, somewhere around the second glass of that single vineyard Central Coast Pinot, moments when the wine stops time, softens anxiety, and opens up a new world of hope. This is a lovely film, more even-toned and less smug, I think, than Payne's last road movie about Schmidt. Payne's framing is relaxed and spacious. Nothing, not even the scene where Miles pours the contents of a spit bucket down his throat, comes off as unduly grotesque. Well, maybe that one does. But Giamatti is buoyant even when sodden, and Thomas Hayden Church has a marvelous etherized sense of entitlement, a spoiled optimism that's pure California. Sideways doesn't spell out the message that Miles and Jack have to get a handle on themselves and stop disappearing sideways into their respective addictions. But that message hangs in the air, the faintest soupçon of rot in an otherwise wondrous bouquet.
David Edelstein is the film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Ferriby is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I can't forget.
On the next Fresh Air, Lenny Kaye. He's Patti Smith's guitarist and the producer of the garage band anthology Nuggets. But his new book is about the 1930s crooner, Russ Colombo. Also, Russell Banks talks about his new novel. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Ah, but I call.